KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM. K296 FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 FM. And K219 KU Nehalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
News Service Store Newscast, November the 11th, 2025. I'm Mike Clifford. The Supreme Court Monday rejected a call to overturn its landmark decision that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide, that from the Associated Press. They report the justices without comment turned away an appeal from Kim Davis, the former Kentucky court clerk who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples after the High Court's 2015 ruling. They report Davis had been trying to get the court to overturn a lower court order for her to pay $360,000 in damages and attorney's fees to a couple denied a marriage license. Meantime, New York voting rights groups are intervening in a lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice.
The DOJ suit against the State Board of Elections seeks the state's private voter roll data, which is information such as driver's license numbers and partial social security numbers. Erica Smitka with the League of Women Voters of New York State notes this information is beyond what's in publicly available voter data. She worries about what this data could be used for.
They may work to attempt to force states to remove voters from the rolls based on that incomplete private data they are asking for. They may use it to target political opponents. We also know that they're working in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security. So they may use this for immigration enforcement.
Smitka also worries if the DOJ obtains this information, it will be used to spread false claims of voter fraud. This is one of several lawsuits the DOJ has filed against states in an effort to get this information. DOJ claims not turning it over violates the National Voter Registration Act and the Help America Vote Act. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
And a coalition of environmental groups is taking its fight for cleaner air to a federal appeals court, aiming to force large-scale factory farms to report toxic emissions under the Federal Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act.
The case could have implications for Florida, a state with a significant agricultural presence. Ryan Mahar, a staff attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, says the legal battle highlights a conflict between industry practices and community right-to-know laws.
Toxic air pollution emitted from factory farms like ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. It's really a transparency concern when it comes to controlling pollution from factory farms. Requiring reporting when there's an emergency, when public health is at risk, is really the bare minimum.
While Florida's regulations exempt these farms from continuous air emissions monitoring, residents in the state's agricultural heartland, like the Suwannee River Basin, have filed numerous health complaints about persistent odor and respiratory issues. The federal appeal seeks to override such exemptions by enforcing a national right-to-know standard. Mahar says the next step is presenting arguments to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals early next year, and hopefully there will be a decision by the end of 2026.
We think the law is on our side, first and foremost.
I'm Tremel Gomes.
This is Public News Service. Indiana will pause together this Veterans Day to honor those who've worn the uniform. We get more from our Joe Ulori.
The Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site in Indianapolis will host a one-minute tribute at sunset on Tuesday. A bugler will play taps from the front porch of the 23rd President's home, and organizers invite Hoosiers across the state to step outside and join in. Charles Hyde, executive director of the Presidential Site, says the idea began in 2020.
We started this in 2020 for the pandemic, but it was important to still have public commemoration. That way any veterans across the state and beyond might hear the strains of taps being played, know that they were being remembered.
The event is live streamed on Facebook, allowing people across Indiana to reflect together. Hyde says anyone, whether they play trumpet, clarinet, or trombone, can participate. The site encourages all musicians to sound taps from their own front doors.
And signs did emerge this week of the government shutdown nearing an end, but hunger relief voices say even if food assistance is back to normal soon, SNAP's November pause could be felt for a while in North Dakota and elsewhere.
Backers of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program say it's uncharted territory because funds were never disrupted like this. The shutdown resulted in a host of delays and court orders when the Trump administration argued it could only authorize partial payments. North Dakota officials recently stated that some recipients could soon access partial benefits, but the Alliance to End Hunger's Karen Aaron says they might have already spent money meant for other expenses on food.
People who participate in SNAP probably do not have a lot in savings that they can draw on. So this can impact their finances not only for November, but into December.
Aarons, who has North Dakota roots, says this state previously had one of the lowest food insecurity rates. But she says it's no longer immune to hunger challenges made worse by higher food costs. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally to Illinois, where an artist is on a mission to bring awareness to an issue that kills billions of birds annually across North America by sawing one cloth bird at a time.
Window strikes killed nearly 1,000 birds in one incident in Chicago in 2023 when they collided with the McCormick Place Lakeside Center. The building has enough windows to cover two football fields, and birds can confuse the reflections for open natural space. Artist and Syracuse University professor Holly Greenberg says she learned about the avian collisions while in Evanston volunteering to restore natural habitat.
This volunteer next to me said, here we are planting all these native plants to build habitat for the birds, and they just come and crash into our windows. And I was like, wait, what?
I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
This story produced with original reporting by Kate Moths with Arts Midwest. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Spotless on the day he said goodbye. Rosy Mount, Copiah, Mississippi, points much further south. It's never light outside yet when they climb into the van. Remember at your peril, forget the ones you can. Leave home feeling empty, change planes in Taipei. Stay awake the whole time, end up several worlds away. The house was almost full that day, they made a space for you. This world is sad and broken, gotta fix a crack or two. Rest until you're rested, climb back onto the caravan.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from McMenamin's historic Mission Theater in downtown Portland, presenting Haitian-born comic Tanel Joaquim on his The Alien Everywhere tour on Wednesday, November 12th. Doors at 7 p.m. and show at 8. Tickets and more information available at missiontheaterpdx.com.
This is Angle of View. Today is November 11th, 2025. I'm Will Hatman. Happy Veterans Day. Nothing will make you feel like more of a sucker than crying at a mediocre movie because of a cue on a song you love, a song that would just as easily make you cry if you heard it in a supermarket bathroom. I got to face this private shame over and over again during Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere, because it is about the making of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska, an album on which just about every song opens me up like a pair of French doors. They're all heard at some point or another in the film, and it's the real recordings that play, and I'm powerless against them. This is a very cheap way of getting me involved. But it's a cheapness appropriate to such a cheap movie, and the only thing that kept me in my seat. Springsteen is a VH1-level biopic about an artist who is famously stable, workmanlike, and dedicated. And it's clear from that description why his story isn't going to work as a movie. It is because the man's personal life has been so mercifully short on fireworks that screenwriter-director Scott Cooper has no choice but to exaggerate and fabricate his way to drama. And so he does, making this uncommonly open-hearted and plain-spoken songwriter into a tormented poet who is unable to love, and whose reason for going out and seizing the world was to try to fill the void where Dad was supposed to be. Depression is supposed to be Springsteen's addiction slash illness slash injury slash prison sentence, because something needs to occupy that space if the structure of the musician biopic is expected to hold. So the movie grabs onto his depression and simultaneously inflates it to that size and frequently forgets about it, because it can't resist the truth of its weak relevance to the great work that Springsteen did and still does when not depressed, which is most of the time. Jeremy Allen White does a passable Springsteen impression. Passable purely because Springsteen is too low-key to lend himself to big gestures, making evaluation difficult. And he's got the soulful, searching eyes of an artist. But he hasn't been given a character to play. For the most part, Cooper sticks to the most worn and obvious devices in the biopic bag, the ones that Walk Hard was supposed to have turned into space junk 20 years ago, but that somehow still haunt us. Childhood scenes in black and white, characters from back home showing up as phantoms later, composite girlfriends telling the artist that he's hiding in his songs, fights with the suits at the label who don't understand art, tearful breakdowns, unconvincing simulations of live performances, and most irresistible of all, the straight line of inspiration, aka this life experience has given me an idea for a song. It is only compelling when the music is directly in focus and the movie can rest its weight on it. These are the precious times when no devices are required. It still doesn't manage anything like a glimpse of the artist's soul, but the fact that the movie is about Nebraska, one of the most intimate and mythologized albums of all time, and probably the world's most famous home recording, gives it a chance to get into some of the double-edged particulars of musical performance, recording, mastering, and marketing. And this is the material it can handle and that we want to see. It's still reductive, as any two-hour movie about a year-plus creative period is forced to be, and it underlines the key points so hard it tears the paper, but at least it's not fundamentally false to the real project or the hard realities of the world of commerce in which it was made. This is the little bit of fun that it's earned the right to have, because it's the fan heart of the movie getting into the bits it's actually excited about. You'll likely forgive a scene of the boss standing outside the recording studio with John Landau, played by a frog-voiced Jeremy Strong, on the night they are about to go track Born in the USA, and telling Landau, "Let's go burn the place down." And then, should your forgiving mood prevail, you might even go easy on the next scene, where the E Street Band lays that legendary song to tape, and the moment fails to conjure a tenth of the real recording's power. The serious problem with the movie is that because Nebraska contains a song called My Father's House, Cooper has decided that Springsteen's relationship with his father is the skeleton key that unlocks his everything. Per Springsteen's own autobiography, his father was mentally unstable and a drinker, and young Bruce's relationship with him was a challenging one. But the nightmare at the level of this boy's life that the film presents seems juiced up all out of proportion to its real significance. In his book, Springsteen describes his childhood as a mixed bag, strained by his father's troubles and other factors, but not to the exclusion of all comforts or moments of wonder, like when he discovered rock and roll. In the movie, Bruce's father is a drunken lout who looms over his trembling son pretty much at all times, defining his life, suggesting that the house was black and white in reality because his presence leached the joy out of it. None of the happy times that the real Bruce describes as having taken place in that house are shown here, not even any of the ones that might have pointed the way to his future as a musician. It's a prison of pure abuse and terror. Even the baseball bat anecdote depicted in the movie is described in the autobiography as something he and his father joked about later, but no jokes are allowed in the house that the movie gives us. Even his dad's laughter in the moment after the bat lands its blow is the sinister and menacing kind. It takes us until our fourth flashback before we even confirm the existence of Bruce's little sister, and she is shown almost apologetically. You can tell Cooper was bummed that his tortured version of boy Bruce, trapped in that awful house, couldn't also be in there all alone. But worse than all this falsification is the pointlessness of it. None of this childhood trauma material relates in any kind of resonant way to the work that Springsteen is shown doing, apart from one moment when a memory of him confronting his father is apparently what convinces him to change the perspective of the song Nebraska from third person to first. And this specific connection is as vague and smeared as the larger one. God knows what this memory and this creative choice have to do with one another. Are we to imagine that Bruce could only put himself in Kit Starkweather's shoes because his confrontation of his father reminded him of when Martin Sheen shoots Sissy Spacek's father in Badlands? Badlands is the foremost element on the album's Heartland of Darkness vision board, along with The Night of the Hunter and the stories of Flannery O'Connor, all influences on the album that Bruce set down in his autobiography and that Cooper puts on screen with the diligence of a student showing his work. Bruce at one point picks up O'Connor's complete stories and flips through it for a second before putting it back down, and Cooper captures this moment like someone photographing proof of having completed part of a scavenger hunt. But what is the deeper connection to America that gave rise to this expression, and the many others that this quintessentially American artist has given us? And why did America respond so forcefully upon hearing it? These are questions that the movie saw fit to ignore while tunneling into the cavern of buried family pain that it dreams up for him. It's implied that his nationality was incidental, but his family circumstances charted the course of his whole life as an artist, even though the former was central to the content of a majority of his songs, and the latter barely surfaced in them. It must be because it was too painful to face. We get two scenes of Landau, after first hearing the Nebraska tape, wondering aloud to his silent wife why an artist of Springsteen's verve has retreated into such a black place and made an album that feels condemned and guilty. And the only lens that Landau, Springsteen's manager who knows him better than anyone, can apply to the work is the same psychoanalytic one that Cooper has glued to the whole movie. This artist must be afraid of success, the same way he's afraid of commitment, love, and everything else. At no point does Landau engage with the songs as American folk songs, songs about figures of legend that stand on their own legs and vibrate inside the country's greater history, the way Flannery O'Connor's stories do, which is what Springsteen was gunning for and what he was protecting when he revoked their studio production values, knowing they were smothering the soul of the work. The real artist's arc in the movie, the one we care about, is this simple and triumphal story. He has his fights over Nebraska, he remains steadfast and reasonable in the way he conceives, presents, and defends the album, he wins his fights. We know the rest, and we know that the first thing we will see after the final cut to black is a card that will read, "Nebraska would go on to become one of Bruce Springsteen's most celebrated albums," a card that by the end we are waiting for with intensifying impatience. But in the eyes of his best friend and confidant, the real meaning is clear. This must be the music of a depressed person. Apparently, an artist's conscious intentions do not matter much. Unconscious drives dictate all. It's much too easy to explain this brilliant and timeless music by draping it in the shroud of mental illness, but at least you get to hear the music itself while you're being led through those explanations. No such comfort attends the relational material in the movie, which is desperate and hackneyed. In his autobiography, Springsteen tells the story of the album's aftermath in broad strokes. He left his 20-year-old girlfriend, relocated to California on a cross-country drive with a friend, and felt his first depressive episode come on while at a carnival, feeling himself totally outside the community that he witnessed there and yearning to join them while feeling that he'd never be able to. That feeling of isolation and separateness is a common depression story, and it's relatable to anyone who has ever felt depressed. We never learn much about his 20-year-old girlfriend in the autobiography, but one presumes he left her because he was leaving New Jersey altogether, and it simply wasn't a serious relationship. In the movie, he wrecks a blossoming romance with a waitress named Faye, who is also a single mother so that she will be more pitiable, because his music doesn't leave enough room in his heart for her, or he's scared of love or commitment or vulnerability or something. The movie is never murkier than here, out at sea in a whole-cloth boat. Then he has a shuddering breakdown at the carnival because he sees a father and son who remind him of himself and his father in a way that is screamingly obvious long before Cooper puts the scene in slow-mo and literally swaps out the actors for the ones who play young Bruce and his father. When he gets to L.A. and is moved into his new house, he phones Landau to say, "I don't know if I can outrun it anymore." If you haven't read the autobiography and read it recently, you are bound to react to this by asking, "Outrun what?" Following his string of victories in the fight for the album, he faces no immediate professional pressures, and both the dad material and the girlfriend material have been such weak tea that you can't ever hold on to a memory of the flavor. So for a second after you hear this line, you literally don't know what he's talking about. I had to return to the book and reread the relevant chapters to remind myself of what truths the film was drawing this blurry melancholy from. But Landau says he understands, because the movie's version of Landau saw this coming, and he'll get him the help he needs. And the main action of the film concludes with another scene that is lifted from the autobiography, but that packs no force in Scott Cooper's hands. Bruce finally sitting down opposite a therapist and breaking into sobs. In the book, this admission is a surprise. In the movie, it's Jeremy Allen White's capstone crying scene to seal his Oscar nomination. This was never going to work. Nebraska is Springsteen's masterpiece precisely because it is a bottomless well of grave mystery. And so a movie, even a movie made by real talents, setting out to tell the story of that album is caught in a double bind from the start. Any attempt at unpacking it is destined to look ridiculous, but what other job could such a movie even aspire to do? I think this realization ought to have been enough to convince Scott Cooper and the film's producers that this wasn't the move, and that maybe, in fact, Springsteen wasn't even the guy. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where a bottomless well of grave mystery is something to shove a flashlight into in hopes of finding money. We live in a world where the biopic is one of the only remaining forms of movie drama trusted to turn a profit, but it needs to hit all the expected beats in order to do so. And we live in a world where producers watch The Bear, see a charismatic actor in his early 30s coming up, and think, you know who he kind of looks like? If you need me, I'll be at my turntable rebuilding the fascination that this movie tried to knock down. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find this and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.
Hey, I'm Ingrid, and I'm in the band Frenzy. Dear Arizona. My Voice Music offers after-school programs, rock camps, studio time, and long-term artist mentorships that help young people 9 to 24 find and share their voice in a safe space to build esteem, social skills, and emotional expression. It's a place where I can express myself when I'm struggling or having a hard time or whatever. Some of the most impactful experiences of my life have happened right here. My Voice Music is proud to join other local nonprofits in this year's Give Guide. More information at giveguide.org.